From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. This podcast version features prose readings from the third annual Lit Crawl Seattle, an event inspired by Litquake, San Francisco's literary festival. Seattle's version is a one-night-only mashup of literary festival and pub crawl. Over 60 authors do their best to silence you or rile you up as you make your way from space to space. Lit Crawl Seattle is a volunteer organization. Readers, hosts, venues, and sponsors donate time, goods, and services to make it possible. This year's sponsors include the Elliott Bay Book Company, Georgetown Brewing Company, Hugo House, Shunpike, Four Culture, and DCG One. The third annual Lit Crawl Seattle took place on October 23, 2014 at venues around Capitol Hill. Thanks to Michelle Goodman and Anna Tatasha for these recordings. This segment was recorded at Still Liquor. The theme is April in October. You'll hear from writers Peter Mountford, Spike Friedman, and Rebecca Brown. Please be advised, the following program contains language of an adult nature.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Still Liquor. If you're hanging out here after Book It, thanks for sticking around. If you just showed up, thanks for coming down here to April and October, just one phase of the multifaceted literary beast that is Lit Crawl 2014. My name's Willie. I'm one of the founders, and I help run April. If you are not familiar with April, it is a annual festival of small press and independent publishing, which those kind of guidelines have dictated the readers we've selected for this reading tonight. And if you want to learn more about April, it's very simple. You just go to aprilfestival.com. That's it. There will be very few. There will be no surveys there. There's no thing you have to fill out. It's pretty basic. So now that my survey joke has fallen flat, you'd think that would go well. But it doesn't. It went really poorly. So it's my pleasure to introduce our first reader of the evening and the man who will be our master of ceremonies, as I am clearly not up to the task, Mr. Peter Mountford. Peter Mountford is the author of, most recently, The Dismal Science, which is out on Tin House, a wonderful press down in Portland. He writes fiction and nonfiction and is the events curator at the Richard Hugo House. Please give a very warm welcome to Peter Mountford.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Willie. Thank you so much to April, everyone involved for bringing me out tonight, and for I'm so excited to hear Spike and Rebecca. It's really great. I'm really glad to be here. Enjoy yourselves. Thanks so much for the beer. It was very nice. Thanks so much, Jessica, for coming out. And congrats to Urban Waite, by the way. His new novel, Sometimes the Wolf, is out yesterday, I think. Yesterday. And not little press. It's not a small press. But nonetheless, we still are proud of him. So I'm going to read a little essay as a sort of throat clearing, amuse-bouche thing to sort of get the night started. And it's a one-page essay. And then I'm going to read from this novel. But the essay is, I call it the Goose Essay, but it's actually called Around the Corner, and I wrote it maybe a month ago. Once, as a child, I almost saw a man kill himself. The boys up at the wall looked at him, and he, weeping, put his head on the tracks. I stood back, watching them watch him, or that's how I remember it. But I also remember his face, so I'm not sure I believe my memory. The boys were hollering with joy, as I recall, but that seems improbable to me now. What I know about people, even cruel children, is that amusement there, in that grisly context, isn't likely. I remember that they averted their eyes at the last second as the train passed, so none of them saw him die either. But yeah, we were all there. Decades later, lying in bed with my girlfriend, I tell her the story, and she says, "Jesus." And I say, do you really believe that they laughed? I do, she says, but I guess I already knew that. Later still, I drive over a goose which walked onto the freeway and just stared at me. I slammed on my brakes, honked at it, but it just stood staring and I couldn't stop, not there, so I drove slowly over it, my back tire lifting a little. In the rear view, I tell my girlfriend on the phone minutes later, it wasn't dead yet. I saw one of its wings extend up toward the sky. Oh, don't tell me that, she implores. I don't want to know. But I didn't kill it, I say, pulling over the shoulder, putting my hazards on. Someone behind me, please, she says. But I'm not done. I need to tell her about the wing pointing upwards, like it wanted to tell me something. I need her to hear that, yes, maybe we're all dying, but it's not my fault. Hey, guys. Thanks, guys. Yeah, hey. Yeah. It's the April. Okay, so I'm reading from this novel, very late in the novel, which is you're not supposed to do, of course. When you read from a novel, you're supposed to read the opening. But I'm going to read the end, so spoiler alerts. You can just plug your ears and hum. This is from the last chapter. This guy, Vincenzo, who was a vice president of the World Bank, has blown up his life and is now in a state of blown up life. He's gone to New York, and he's living in a hotel. And his daughter lives in New York, but he's been there for a few weeks, and he hasn't told her yet that he's in New York because he doesn't want to see her. Or he doesn't want to see anyone. I think that's all you need to know. But in fact, he was already in New York. He'd been in New York for 3 weeks. He ate dinner at the far end of the bar in the top floor restaurant at the W Hotel. There were two bartenders who worked the night shift. Trent, an aspiring graphic designer who was chillingly, exhaustingly ambitious, and Rachel, who made paintings, as she put it, in a linguistic contrivance that he hadn't encountered before. Rachel reminded him of his daughter, Leonora, minus the politics and maybe minus the problem of real and unrecoverable loss, minus that fury. But maybe Rachel was just sanitizing herself for her customer's benefit. Maybe the paintings she made were Marx's drivel. He asked about her father once, a few days prior, and the question had compelled her to say that her father was dead. With this, unfortunately, he saw that this was probably why she had reminded him of Leonora. She wasn't missing the loss at all, just hiding it. I'm sorry, he'd said. She shrugged and shook her head, because what else was there to say? Then, as usual, he drove right past his misgivings. He couldn't help himself. There'd be no scab left unpicked. One way or another, he'd worry the wound until it bled freely again. How did he die? He asked. She drew a sharp breath, and he could see how much she wished he hadn't asked that. Then, exhaling, she said, he killed himself, and presented a tight-lipped smile, bug-eyed, as if shocked by the news herself. As if she wanted to put together a joke to help Vincenzo through the information, but no joke would help. It was a familiar expression. It was the face of maturing but fixed and intractable sorrow. He knew some things he could say, but those things would just mend the awkwardness on top, so he didn't speak. So he goes to a restaurant where his daughter works. She's not there. Thank God. So he doesn't see her, and he does some other stuff. And then he ends up at this gallery at the very end of the book, this art gallery. He's not really into art. He's sort of a stodgy, middle-aged Italian guy, and he hasn't really familiarized himself with contemporary art in any way, shape, or form. But his old colleague from the World Bank, who now works at this lovely place called Lehman Brothers, and is an investment banker from hell, but he has, in the manner of many middle-aged investment bankers, has taken up with a very young and very beautiful artist. She has a show in this gallery in Chinatown, and it's a video art show. And Vincenzo, for reasons that he doesn't understand himself, I don't think, he ends up there. At first, there appeared to be no one in the gallery in Chinatown. Then a pasty, middle-aged woman, scrawny and hunched, emerged. She wore noisy clogs, maroon-colored. They pounded the floorboards. Her hair, a nest of curls, mounded extravagantly on top of her head and was a compellingly unnatural coppery hue. The hair seemed to ignite under the halogens so that she looked ethereal, some luminous city-dwelling sprite or ghoul. "Can I help you?" she said. Her skin was moist, ashen. "Is Gillian Tillman's video, do you have her art here?" "It's a video," he said. Gillian Tillman was Colin's girlfriend, the video artist. Though Vincenzo had never met her, had never seen any video art at all, to the best of his knowledge, he wanted to know what she did ever since Colin had described it to him over lunch in that room on the top of the Lehman Brothers building. Pages. The gallery owner sat him down in a small room at the back. There were several simple wooden seats, black curtains boxing him in, a flat-screen television mounted on the wall. She closed the curtain behind her, and he sat in the darkness as the large screen awakened. In the video, a blonde and freckled young pixie of a girl with an aquiline face and a bunched-up mouth, large and intelligent eyes, licked her lips and then had a sip of wine. She readied herself, staring nervously at the camera. A clock in the corner ticked away the time. It was mostly dark in the room, and someone could be heard snoring, no doubt Colin. She scratched her forehead, had another sip of wine. She started to appear amused, and her mirth grew until she had to stifle a laugh. And all the while, she was staring straight out at the screen at Vincenzo, who sat alone in the darkness. Then this elfin little girl had a sip of wine and began to speak. "Today I sat here and listened to this car outside, and it sounded awful," she said. "The engine, I mean, like it sounded like it was revving itself to death. You could smell it even up here. And I gotta say, I loved it. Like, I mean, I really loved it. Who is doing that? And while we're at it," she stopped to inhale sharply, and he saw her expression change subtly but completely. "I know that there had been another life that I could have had, and I don't know whether it would have been better, but I think I would have liked that one too. Just a couple more turns to the left or a couple more to the right, and I would have had a different life right now." She had a sip of wine, lit a cigarette. During the pause, the snoring behind her grew louder. A backdrop of digitally animated stars appeared in the darkness of that room and commenced twinkling and turning, moving slowly across the screen, spinning gradually. She sighed. She looked exhausted, ready to cry. "Look," she said, "I'm sorry, but I just don't care anymore. The car, this here too, and you, it was..." She shook her head. "I shouldn't have done this either." Then she glanced at the camera and whispered hoarsely, "This was a terrible idea." But instead of turning it off, she lingered. She sat there for a minute, face scrunched up, staring at nothing. Eventually, she looked back at the camera and said, "I guess that's everything." The clock in the corner said that the video had been playing for 3 minutes. Vincenzo reached out and picked up his overcoat, but the camera stayed on her, so he paused in case there was more. The video kept going. He lay his coat across his lap. The fake stars continued to twinkle behind her in the bedroom, and she sat smoking cigarette after cigarette in silence for the next hour. When the clock in the corner read 1 hour and 4 minutes and 55 seconds, she stubbed out yet another cigarette and glanced at the camera and said, "Thanks for sticking around." Then she reached out behind the camera toward the off switch, and he knew that the video was about to end, and in a matter of seconds, the gallery owner would pull open the curtain and ask him if he were still awake. So he tried to dig into the moment as deeply as he could. He tried to stretch it out, to hide here on this side of the line. But the video was already over, and he could already hear those clogs on the floor. And he knew it was all of it was already over. That's all. Thanks. So I met Spike the other day. I didn't realize it was Spike. I met this guy. He was at the Hugo House. He was writing for The Stranger about the football. And we were showing a football game at Hugo House, and I was like, this is cool that this guy is doing this. And then I realized it's Spike. This is the same guy. He's this wonderful playwright as well. He writes for The Stranger, obviously, but he also writes plays, and he's a improv actor. Spike, here's the official bio, by the way. Spike Freeman is a playwright and a stand-up comic whose latest play, Returning to Albert Joseph, was produced by the Satori Group this spring. He writes for Grantland and, as I mentioned before, The Stranger. Please give a big round of applause.
Thank you. I'm not used to speaking into two microphones at once. All right, so tonight I'm going to tell the story of three Jewish holidays as they were told to me as a child. But first, allow me to contextualize a little bit. These are the versions of these stories written by my grandfather, Murray Friedman, in the late 90s as part of a fiction workshop that he participated in after being told that he had the least empathy of any engineer at the aerospace contracting firm for which he'd been working at the time. His main takeaway from the workshop was the most important part of storytelling is writing what you know. I'll also add that this was around the time my grandfather disowned my father for remarrying non-Jewish women two times, the disowning and the remarrying. And he went full out with the disowning, sitting shiva for my dad, who's still alive. Yeah, I think, okay, that's all that I need in the way of context. So please enjoy The Friedman Family Tales of the Jewish Holidays is written by my grandfather, Murray Friedman. The story of Passover. We're saving our firstborn son, my wife Bertha tells me. I don't look up from my roasted lamb. How is this a question, she asks. You're rubbing the blood on the door and we're saving him. He's already dead, I say. Which is kind of true as he is dead to me, but in another way not true as he is still alive. He's not dead, Bertha replies. Be serious. What if it's a crock, I say. Moses is a weirdo. He's a shirker down at the pyramids, and he's a weirdo. You've seen him. He's noticeably weird. This is probably a crock. Her eyes widen. Water turned into blood. Frogs fell from the sky. Also, it got dark for a while. Please. Murray. Bertha looks at me, and I see her hands are trembling. I can tell it's hard for her to speak to me. I don't know why she is subservient in every way to me because of the gender that she was born with and our relationship as man and wife. I don't see why anything needs to be challenging about that. The relationship is clearly defined. That should make it easier for her to speak to me because there's no room for misunderstanding within the context of our relationship. Because of the gender-based subservience. It's defined that way to avoid just this sort of awkwardness. I don't understand why this isn't working. The gender-based subservience, that is. Why isn't it working? Also, she knows how I feel about my firstborn son, Mark. I think it's a load that he agreed to marry that Egyptian woman with the weird name. Save Mark? Feh. I shake my head. She continues to appeal to me. We're Jews. How many wins do we get? Not many. All we have to do is rub lamb blood on our door and we will save lives. This is the one win we're going to get. We're Jews. This is it. This right here. Take it. She repeats herself. We're Jews. Are we Jews? I ask rhetorically. Of course we, she and I, are Jews, but this wicked son of hers? Feh. I push lentils around on my plate. Are you serious? She asks. I forget that I only thought the part about she and I being Jews, so I clarify that out loud and then sigh. I'm tired. I've been building pyramids since as far back as I can remember, and I'm tired. Every day I'm hearing about curse this and exodus that. The foreman on the trap corridor project I've been working on has been a real pain in the ass all week. He's so preoccupied about the threat of his firstborn son dying, he assigns me, an upper manager, the tasks of putting snakes into walls. That's work for plebes. I'm tired. This conversation is over, I say. I tell her to dispose of the shanks and any and all shanks. I want them in the garbage, not fouling up our door frames. She looks at me, pleading with her eyes, and so I explain. The Torah refers to four sons: the wise, the wicked, the simple, and the unable to ask. And while the Torah may be naming sons metaphorically, we literally have four sons, and our firstborn son happens to be the wicked one. So, two birds, one stone. Or one frog, if that's how this all goes down, I say with a laugh. I'm pretty funny when I choose to be. I feel like the tension is cut, and I go to bed. However, I wake the next morning to see lamb's blood on our doorframe. Apparently, Bertha put it there, and Mark survived the night. Good for him. I learned a valuable lesson in disposing of waste myself. Now every year we gather to drink four glasses of wine and hide some crackers. It's uncomfortable. The story of Hanukkah. We're at war, you know, I tell my son Mark. I don't have time for you not wanting to have sex exclusively with Jewish women right now. Do you know how much oil is left? He shrugs. I yell, that's your one job, to know how much oil is left. Not as you seem to think, have sex with non-Jewish women. How much oil is left? Basically none, he says. So maybe it's good that my marriage has given us some non-Jewish allies. I scoff at his cowardice. Let me see the oil-holding jug, I say, forgetting if there's a word for such things. He stares at me. I try to see a bit of myself in his eyes. I fail. Feh. He hands me the jug. I look at it. It'll last, I say, even though I'm unsure of the exact measurements. My ally is my sacrilegious sexual partner, and you're wrong, he replies. Well, my ally is God, I say. It will last. Go play with your top. And that's how the dreidel game started, with my son gambling while I watched over the occasion of a miracle. Finally, the story of Rosh Hashanah. Happy New Year, I say, and blow on one of those party blowers that you would buy at a cheap party store if such things were around in the Holy Land, but they weren't, so let's say I got it from some sort of peddler. I imagine peddler would be those who sell such things. The blower goes out, and then it comes back in, but it does not make a sound. I look at the party blower and say, this is no good. This will not do. This will not do at all. It's New Year's, and I'm a shepherd, so I look outside at my flock. They are peaceful, save for that one piece of ram who just happens to share a name with my firstborn son, Mark. He's a really ornery ram, always having sex with non-Jewish non-rams. This ram is an affront to God. This ram is dead to me already, so I grab my horn-cutting knife. Hours pass. Shofar, so good, I say to myself. And blow into a ram's horn. I'm quite funny when I choose to be. Too bad no one is around this New Year's to hear my hilarious joke or the beautiful sound of my breath coursing through a ram's horn. Fah, their loss. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Spike. That was very rousing. That's good. Thank you. It's my great pleasure to introduce one and only Rebecca Brown, who is the author of, at last count, 12 books, but nobody's actually keeping count anymore, including Rebecca. Is that true? No, you're not keeping track. Many from the storied City Lights books in San Francisco. She was the inaugural Richard Hugo House Writer in Residence, and is the recipient of the 2005 Stranger Genius in Literature and numerous other awards. And she teaches in various places around town, including the University of Washington in Bothell, and she teaches at the Low-Res program in Goddard. And thank you so much. It's such a great pleasure to have Rebecca to the stage. Yeah.
Okay, so when I was thinking about what to read in a bar, I asked my spouse, and she was like, what should be funny or sexy? And then I thought, okay, I'm reading with a guy, so I'd read a story about being a girl with the guys. And I thought, we're in a bar and it's 21 only, so I would read a story about childhood that has a tiny bit of alcohol in it. And also because I'm an American. This is called The Trenches. When we were kids, we were a gang. There was only one other girl, somebody else's little sister, who we didn't like, but her mother was never home, so her brother had to bring her. We made her the enemy or a spy or defector or somebody already dead or being tortured, though sometimes we let her be the nurse if she could beg somebody's mother for something to eat and bring it back for us. Except for me, there was only her. I didn't want to be like her, and I didn't want them to think of me like her. At first, she tried to tag along with me, but after a while, she gave up. We all rode bikes together, the rest of us. She only had a trike. We played tree forts and baseball and football and soccer and war. We played in our yards and in the alleys behind our yards and in the vacant lot with all the broken bottles and piles of ancient dog and the brown flowered sprung out couch and down past where the road ended, and there was a ravine. We slid down the ravine and scraped our elbows and hands and tore the backs of our pants and coughed on the dirt we'd stirred up and ripped our shirts. There was one boy a few grades ahead of us, but the rest of us never thought it was strange that we were the only ones he played with. I don't know if he thought about this then or ever. I hope not. He didn't need to be more miserable than he was. Nobody should be that miserable. He was the one we had learned about the trenches from in school, and he told us about the trenches. The trenches, he said, were terrible. They were truly terrible. The trenches. The way he said it, the way we all said it forever after, it was never like the trenches with a little T, but always the trenches, capitalized. The trenches. How we love to say those words. The trenches. The trenches. The trenches. We went to the bottom of the ravine in the muddy creek bed where sometimes water ran until our shoes got wet, and we pretended that we had been for months in the trenches. We pretended that our feet were white and peeling and soft as worms, that we had trench foot, trench mouth, trench fever. When we had to go home, we crawled around into our front yards beneath the box hedges that we pretended were trees in the black forest and under clotheslines that we thought were electric wires. And we screamed and grimaced as we climbed over the chain link fences between our yards as if they were electrocuting us. We spread dirt and grass and water from the garden hose on our faces to make us look like we'd gotten muddy and sweaty from crawling in the jungles in the Philippines or where we were in camouflage. And we flung ourselves on the ground and shouted, "I'm hit! I'm hit!" Then we crawled along as if our legs were broken or our guts were hanging out, trying to get back to our buddies. Then we made shooting sounds and we flipped up off the ground and twisted around in the air, then fell back down again and cried and moaned in cheerful agony, "Oh, God, I'm hit, oh God." Then we would groan, crawl, scrape, ooze, collapse until one of our brave buddies braved his way out across the bloody, body-strewn battlefield to drag us back away from the machine gun fire, the torpedoes, bombs, bazookas, machetes, grenades, Gatling guns, mobile bombs, bottle rockets, Molotov cocktails, cannonballs, hydrogen bombs, and A-bombs. Because the trenches were terrible. They were truly terrible. The trenches were full of rats and mud and sewer water up to your ankles. The rats were huge, as big as cats and always hungry, ravenous. They could eat a horse with huge, sharp, dripping teeth, and they carried horrible, excruciating, incurable diseases, and the trenches were always cold and dark and slimy and also had snakes in them. Huge, big, fat ones as gross as eels, as strong as boa constrictors, and fat, skinny ones more poisonous than rattlers, the rattlers we had in Texas. And the trenches also stank from all the guys who hadn't taken a bath in months. But also, even more, in fact, they stank from the horrible, terrible, grotesque wounds the guys had gotten from that had been left untreated. And the guys had arms, whole arms or parts of arms, shot off so they couldn't even hold their guns with both hands, just one or a nub, but they would hold their guns if it was the last thing they did. By God, they held their guns. They also had their legs cut off, one or both, all the way or part of the way, below the knee or in the middle of the thigh, or they couldn't walk anymore, just hobble and lurch and fall around, knocking against the sides of the trenches or against each other. Sometimes they'd have to grab me to keep from falling. It was like being grabbed by a zombie. They dragged themselves along the ground through the mud and the snakes and the sewer water, and they smashed, crushed, limp, paralyzed, lacerated legs or parts of legs, dragging behind them like the hag, like bags of sand. They also had their gut shot out or stabbed or bayoneted out, and not even part way out, just part of the way out, which was worse because if you were still alive and you could feel everything, you could feel your guts and your stomach and intestines were hanging out, and you hold a head to hold onto them to keep them from falling into the sewer water where the rats would eat them while they were still partly attached to you, and you could feel a horrible, filthy, ratty, diseasy teeth eating at you. We loved this. We loved being the men who lived in the trenches, doing what had to be done. Nobody else would do it, but it had to be done, so we did it. Of course, some of them died, which is when you would have to lie there until it was time to go home for dinner, or until he said you could be alive again for another assault. You didn't want to die early because then there was nothing to do. You just had to lie there and people would walk on your dead body and you couldn't do anything because you were dead. But in some ways, the ones who did die were actually the lucky ones because the ones who didn't die, they suffered. They truly, truly suffered. The suffering guards would beg you to be put out of their misery, and then when you could, you would. You would shoot them in the face, right between the eyes, or put the barrel of the gun right in their temple and you would shoot them there. But that was only if you could, because sometimes you were so low on ammo you couldn't afford to waste one single bullet on a guy of yours who was suffering. Even if he was begging, pleading, truly, really suffering, because you might use that, need that very bullet. It might be your very last bullet to shoot some Jap or some German or some spy, whoever's coming into the trench with you. So sometimes you had to bludgeon your guy with your butt of your gun, or you had to put your boot in his neck or just press it and strangle it with your bare hands. And that was even only if you could, if you were lucky, and that's a big if. If, for example, you were not being bombarded at that very moment by an entire platoon of rabid, insane Japanese people, or grenaded by a battalion of ruthless, sadistic Germans, in which case your guy just had to sit there and suffer, truly suffer, while you tried to hold off the entire Japanese battalion on your own. You couldn't take care of him while he was lying there suffering, or if he was still mobile, going insane, crawling around in what was left of his bloody stumps of legs and arms, which were bloody as meat bones, bloody as T-bone steaks, bloody as dog food, bloody as the dog itself after it was hit by the Camaro, because you had to do what you had to do. Actually, though, it was often the girl who was just lying there like that, so she, not he, had to just lay there, hanging onto her stomach or guts or intestines, as we instructed her to her head where her brains were oozing out of her ear and she was flapping one of her eyes. And the other one was just an empty socket, which we'd half shot out and it was hanging down. We loved to play like this. Actually, some of the horribly wounded guys in the trench had been treated, but only superficially because we didn't have the right supplies. We could only wrap our bloody stumps with filthy, crusty, bloody, raggedy wrappings that had previously been wrapped around some other guy whose leg or arm or head had been blown off. Then after he had died, we took the wrapping off and put it on another guy who was still living, even if the new guy might get the dead guy's germs, because it was better to only take the chance of getting everybody's germs and dying rather than definitely dying because you lost all your blood. So we wrapped ourselves with filthy, crusty, raggedy rags that held the blood and the brains and the guts of the other dead guys, and then around our wounds, which, dangerous as it was like blood brothers, which was being like blood brothers, even if it was blood brothers with a dead guy. No one wanted the girls' rags, and she didn't try to make us take them, but sometimes there was no alternative, so we took the girls' rags anyway, and she didn't try to stop us. After a while, the girl stopped trying anything. She stopped doing anything. In the trenches, the guys could only amputate, we'd also love that word, with their own knives or bayonets, which were steak knives or bread knives. But we had to do it all without medicine or anything to put you under. But sometimes, if someone had some, you could have a slug of rum or of whiskey. One time, someone actually did bring a bottle of whiskey from their father's house. It was Scotch malt whiskey, and we all tried it, even the girl. Her brother held her mouth open while the boy, who was a few grades ahead of us, poured the malt whiskey in the girl's mouth, almost all of which I watched, though at the very last minute I closed my eyes, which I hope no one would notice, But then right after that, I very quickly drank a slug myself. But mostly there was no medicine or whiskey, so you had to bite on a bullet to keep from yelling out loud, or if not a bullet, because you didn't have any bullets left, not one single bullet, and you were just sitting in the trench like sitting ducks waiting to get it. You would have to bite on the bloody rag of someone who had died before you. Then you would taste their blood, which tasted like metal, and their brains, which tasted like chicken. And you had to put something in your mouth because no matter how much you were in, you couldn't scream or moan because the Japs might hear you and they would find you, and you had to be absolutely silent. The girl became the best at this. If you made a sound, your buddies would have to hit you for your own good and for the good of the company, and sometimes put a handkerchief in the girl's mouth, even if she wasn't making noises, and her brother held her down and put the handkerchief in, and after a while, the girl didn't even squirm. When we had to come over the trenches at night, we did what we had to be done. We spread mercurochrome all over our hands and legs and arms, and we called it blood, and we drew stitches on our arms and legs and guts with magic markers, and one time someone had a jar of mayonnaise and we blobbed it on us like pus. We walked with limps that we called our war wounds, and we lurched along like Frankenstein, and we flapped our arms around, and we dragged our knuckles along the ground like apes as if our backs were broken and we couldn't stand up straight. And once we saw a man who walked like that, or it was a kid, we actually couldn't tell. We couldn't tell how big or small or old that person walking that way was, or even if it was a guy or a girl, and that person couldn't stand up and his arms flapped around, and we didn't think of him like a guy who got a war wound in the trenches, and we didn't think of that. This is what we did when we were kids. Then we grew up.
Thank you very much for coming. One more round of applause, please, for Peter Mountford, Spike Friedman, Rebecca Brown.
Thanks for listening to this Lit Crawl Seattle 2014 podcast from Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9. If you appreciate the series, please give us a good review. It helps more people find us. Lit Crawl Seattle is a volunteer organization. Readers, hosts, venues, and sponsors donate time, goods, and services to make it possible. This year's sponsors included the LA Bay Book Company, Georgetown Brewing Company, Hugo House, Shunpike, 4 Culture, and DCG1. The third annual Lit Crawl Seattle took place on October 23, 2014, at venues around Capitol Hill. Thanks again to Michelle Goodman and Anna Tadashev for these recordings. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.